You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Thank you for having me here. Like Amar said, you know, I come from the cultural heritage world. Really, I spent a little bit of time in the technology sector long enough to realize I never wanted to work for a corporation, and then got into the library world. I became a librarian in 2004, specifically with the intent of working on digital libraries. So that's my background. I'm here today to introduce the Open Knowledge Commons and talk about our agenda, and hopefully get a lot of feedback on you, from you on it. We're a very early stage. We were just incorporated in the end of September 2008. We grew out of the open content movement. The Alfred P. Sloan Foundation has funded us, and they funded a lot of early work in the open content movement. They were funding large digitization projects. And they became aware of a need for a central coordinating body, not only to help the projects, communicate with each other, but also to do advocacy for an open digital library. Our goal is no less than the ideal. You know, we think that we are memory institutions. We've long lived in the realm of ideals. We're shooting for a universal digital library, global in scope, multilingual, and open to all. So our activities are really clustered in these two areas to start off. Advocacy, not only in our own profession, in the libraries, museums, and archives world, there's a lot of interested parties, but not everyone is aware of the long-term implications of some of the events that are going on now, so we want to work there. Also in the public sector, you know, there are some commercial projects happening that provide access. We want to make sure people understand use of information. You know, access is one thing, really being able to use content is another. And legislative advocacy, we really want to push for better access, certainly to orphan works. We're also going to be doing practical steps. We'll be coordinating projects. It's much too early stage to talk about anything in specific right now, but one of the things that we're working on is an idea for what we're calling the Library of North America, where we would, in a distributed way, digitize all books that were printed in and about America from the very beginning on. Now, some of this exists in clusters. There's a commercial project that's digitized maybe 30% of that literature, but you have to pay a subscription for it, even though it's all in the public domain. So we would like to take this content that is already in libraries and make it open and make it available for use. The humanists are really excited about having a large corpus that they can work on with the technologies that they already very well know how to use, like text extraction, named entity analysis, topic clustering, all of these things. So if we build that kind of a corpus, they will be very grateful. Now, I just wanted to go into our name. You know, we're the Open Knowledge Commons. What does that actually say about what our goals are? Open, I think, is pretty self-explanatory. Open means without enclosure. Knowledge is harder to define. There's no good pat definition. You know, what is knowledge? So for our purposes, we're talking about knowledge as the sum total of all recorded history, and then the cognitive processes that get applied to that content to create new learning and innovation and creativity. We want to go beyond content. You know, content is about transforming materials, but knowledge is about use. A commons, this is Mike Edson from the Smithsonian's definition of a commons. It's a set of resources maintained in the public sphere for the use and benefit of everyone. And that's inherently different than commercial interests, which have no really impetus to build in interoperability because there's a need to protect an investment. So an open knowledge commons we see as this ideal place where there are shared public resources, there's a pooling and transfer of knowledge, there's lots of interaction, and it's governed by community ethics. You know, the members of the commons understand that they're working towards a mutual good, a great public good. So there's no enclosure and limitless possibilities. I like that image. What is not a commons is a walled castle. you know, with one drawbridge entrance and a moat. And if, you know, if we think of our heritage as being inside that castle, we'd really much rather see it in open fields with multiple entrances and without that one entryway where the bridge keeper might decide to pull up the bridge or charge a large amount of money for that access. So that's not what we want to aim for. I think our philosophy springs straight out of the American Public Library movement, which was very fertile right here in Boston. There was this notion that, you know, it came on the heels of private libraries and subscription libraries, and the notion emerged that if the great public could have access to knowledge, that it would be elevating, that a great public good would emerge from that. So Josiah Quincy Jr. in 1847 created this legislation to municipally fund public libraries. I come from the Boston Public Library, which was the result of that legislation, and there are these iconic words carved into the entrance of the library, free to all, and that's become a bit of a mantra for the open content and the open knowledge movement. We stretch that a little further and say that open access inspires innovation and creativity that's much needed. I just like this quote. It's James Russell Lowell. It's from later. It's from the 1880s, but he says, if we cannot equalize conditions and fortunes any more than we can equalize the brains of men, we can yet perhaps do something to correct those methods and influences that lead to enormous inequalities and to prevent their growing more enormous. That's still an ideal today. We are today in this interesting time where this historic transition is going on, where we've got all of this analog knowledge and we've got to convert it to digital format because it's the preferred format for use. And we're looking at how we best do that. In the analog world, there was the doctrine of first sale that allowed us to buy collections, acquire collections, and loan them out. Fair use was a judgment call, but it was certainly a lot easier than in the digital world, where licensing is the predominant means of distribution, and there are copyright concerns just because of the medium. Fair use is a more difficult call.
Excuse me, can you unpack that doctrine for sale? The term I've heard, but I wasn't really familiar with it.
Doctrine for sale, once you've bought an item, once you've bought a book, the rights of the creator of that no longer apply to your, you can do whatever you want to do with that. So you can loan it out even if it's under copyright. That's my bad non-legal definition. I'm sure you all have a much better definition. So back to, you know, where we came from. We come from this open content movement. It started really back in the 70s with Project Gutenberg, which was a project to key in texts, full texts of public domain works. They're still going. They've got about 25,000 public domain books keyed in. It's a great distributed project. Later came the Million Books Project, or the Universal Digital Library Project. That was probably 2001, 2002, funded by the NSF and many others. The Ministry of Education in China has funded a large chunk of that. That project is more of a research project. They've already digitized about 1.5 million books, but they're looking at things like solving problems with OCR of difficult languages, of Arabic script, for example. And they're digitizing in copyright works, but asking for permission to distribute those works. They're focused on agriculture, and there's the notion behind that was that the flow of knowledge from developed countries to underdeveloped countries would be facilitated. So that's a great project. And then there's the Internet Archive. The Internet Archive was very active in the Million Books Project, and then in 2005 got together with Yahoo and Microsoft to create a project, probably in response to the Google 2004 book scanning project, that would digitize the world's great libraries, but would do it openly. So Brewster Kahle, who's the founder of the archive and the librarian of the archive, is a very vocal proponent of open content. He's done a lot of great work. One of the things that resulted from that is this scanning center, which is a picture of over at the Boston Public Library. We house what's called the Northeast Regional Scanning Center. This is a self-funded, this is unique. It's self-funded by the 20 libraries of the Boston Library Consortium. So a lot of digitization has been done with funding from Sloan or Microsoft, but the Boston Libraries felt that it was important enough to make this transition that they would dig into their own budgets and provide a model for the rest of the country to show that it was indeed possible to collaborate on creating collections and to self-fund. So there's about 10 of, there are 10 of these stations. They're called Scribes. They run two shifts and they're digitizing books from BC, BU, UMass, UNH, Brown, 20 local libraries. And the result of that is not only this center, but many across the country, is that we've now got about 500,000 open books scanned. And they are showing up and being used in multiple ways. This is the Biodiversity Heritage Library project. There's about 10 major natural history institutions, botanical gardens, research institutions that got together to digitize the entire biodiversity literature. And what that does is they apply their subject discipline so that their taxonomic knowledge doesn't get lost in just the process of digitizing. They're able to connect the dots of taxonomies that have changed over time. So if a species was called something in the 18th century and it's gone through three name iterations today, scientists around the world are using their knowledge to connect those dots so that it's not just a bunch of digitized books, it's actually got the result of all of this knowledge built into it. Then, of course, there's the Internet Archive, where you've got hundreds of thousands of open books available. And there's a new project that's come out called the HathiTrust. Hathi is very interesting. It's some of the Google libraries that also have digitized a lot of open content, and they're storing everything together in a central repository. It's governed by a community of institutions, and we like that model very much. It's moving beyond the institutional repository to a big cluster resource. So we're watching that and talking to them a lot. Now, we were talking earlier about, you know, why open content? What are we trying to accomplish here? And what we really want is, you know, we know that online access increases use. But we've also seen that open access doesn't decrease, it can also increase sales. We want to drive home the message that, you know, Cory Doctorow says it really well. I'm looking to find ways to use copying to make more money, and it's working. Enlisting my readers as evangelists and giving them free ebooks to distribute sells more books. It's a win-win. You know, we need this, we need creators to move out from behind the walls of trying to hold on to everything and to embrace this as a distribution strategy. And certainly, I love Tim O'Reilly says, it's, you know, my problem isn't piracy, it's obscurity. The circulation of content will actually help sales. And that's one of the principles that we build into our work. So our ideal is to build this truly open environment that includes software, that includes data. It's not just content. We'd like to work with publishers and authors to get freely licensed works or non-commercial licensed works. There's talk of a massive public works project. You know, we've all been in the middle of this economic crunch and have heard a lot about possible jumpstart programs doing public works projects. And yes, it's very important to build bridges and roads, but in a country like ours that's founded on principles of democratic access to information, would it not also be a very valuable public good to create an open information infrastructure to enlist large numbers of people across the country in this work of transformation? Would that not be a very good use and value? We'd like to see a central registry that covers all formats and all creators, not only authors of books that belong to specific organizations. like to work with fulfillment vendors for print on demand and other commercial uses, and to create a research corpus with no limitations on use of non-consumptive research. So consumptive research is research on the corpus of all of this digitized material that actually makes, that reproduces specific passages, say, out of that corpus. Non-consumptive use is doing text mining, doing data extraction, and finding out new knowledge. We think that there should be, the research corpus is for us one of the most interesting aspects of being able to digitize everything. I mean, for the first time we have the ability to assemble all human knowledge and to work on it. So we'd like to see that available with no limitations. You know, the Google Books settlement calls for a research corpus, but it limits use to non-commercial products. And we'd like to see something different. That's funny. You know, I was reading Jonathan Zittrain's Future of the Internet and How to Stop It, and it may be a stretch, but I was drawing a parallel between his discussion of the generative information ecosphere and a non-generative environment. And, you know, he talks about the open internet, the generative internet winning out over proprietary content networks. And I think we're seeing a parallel in the content world. You know, there are a number of examples, and I'm not picking on anyone. Publishers helped us for a long time make works that were in geographically dispersed areas available. So there were good business models that were built on that. We didn't have the capacity to do it at the time. We now do have the capacity to do that. So we'd like to move into that generative environment. I was online and I was trying to look at Harper's Weekly. It's in the public domain. I am a card-holding member of the Boston Public Library, but I couldn't get on remote access to the database because I wasn't in the library. There's a specific licensing agreement that limits use to inside the walls of the library. We'd like to shoot for the ideal. A great generative environment that's gotten a lot of buzz lately, the Flickr Commons. The Library of Congress just released a report on their pilot project with Flickr Commons. Now, we all know Flickr. Flickr Commons is where a number of cultural heritage institutions are pulling their collections and putting them out there so that people can tag them and add to them. And they are absolutely overwhelmed at the response they've gotten. Now, Library of Congress has had their works online for a very long time, but they've gotten, you know, unprecedented number of eyeballs on their content. They've also gotten, you know, 67,000 tags added in a number of months. It's a very short period of time. There's been very, very little bad behavior. You know, this is the notion of the commons. It's for a mutual good. There were less than 25 instances of, you know, bad user generated content. And they even got some catalog records enhanced by the public. So Library of Congress was able to share. By the same token, they've been able to pull back the information and use it to make their own information better or to assimilate it with their information. That's a wonderful illustration of a generative information commons. Now, you know, I started at the end of September, and just as we were plugging in phones and getting ready, you know, some things started happening, and I wanted to talk about them today, really to show the ideal and to show what's happening in the real world, because I think our ideal is going to be shaped by these real world events if we don't carefully look and understand the implications. So the two big things that have gone on are the Google Book Search copyright settlement, which I'm sure most of you have heard about. It provides subscription access to out of print and copyright books that have been digitized at some of the world's great research libraries, including Harvard and, you know, public and Oxford and Stanford and University of Michigan, among many others. Then there's the policy for use and transfer of WorldCat records. Might not know about that, but we in libraries use a cooperative cataloging utility where it's kind of like Napster for catalog records, except there's payment involved. A library will upload a record for a book. Other libraries can download those records and attach their own holdings to it. But the work that's been done, the data that's been put in, has been the work of librarians across the country. And I'll talk about that in a second. But to get to the Google book settlement, now, you know, Google caused us to think on a scale that we weren't ready to think on yet. And they caused us to consider things that were, in our minds, very, very far away. So that was a wonderful thing. And you know, in the meantime, since 2004, they've scanned 7 million books. The Google Book Settlement calls for creation, really, of a licensing body that provides subscription access to those books, some fee-based services, some open services. Public libraries can get one terminal with access to this big database of Google Books, and it provides for the creation of that research corpus that I was talking about earlier. So I'd like to just run through some of the major points of it that we see where we'd still like to reach for that ideal. Orphan works. You know, the Book Rights Registry covers authors and books in the Association of American Publishers and the Authors Guild. So the win is that there's definitely much greater access for the public. They used to be able to show only snippet views. Now they can show much more content. And it's also a mechanism to unorphan books, to claim orphan books and receive payment for their use. The losses are, it applies really only to Google. So no one else can have the protection afforded by the settlement. It doesn't apply to any other formats. We're really only talking about books here and other creators outside of these organizations. So we're still hoping that congressional action will help us open that up and be able to provide much broader access to orphan works. The research corpus. The settlement creates two major research institutions where the entire scanned corpus, the entire digitized corpus, is available for computational analysis. That's a great thing. People have been waiting for that for a long time. On the other hand, the research has to be approved by Google and the BRR. So, you know, in all fairness, research would probably have to be approved by some coordinating body because not everyone has access to, you know, grid computing and high volume computing, so you can't have everyone there. But what's kind of, you know, not the ideal is that the results of that research can't be used for any commercial purpose without approval of the registry and Google. So what does that mean for us? We have this moment where we can actually really assemble knowledge and pull new information out of it. And why would the fruits of that be restricted to non-commercial use? Something I'm really interested in what you have to say about privacy.
Do you know what the argument was that led to that cause being in there?
But
makes sense
for
Google,
though.
There you go.
Well, let me offer a technical reason, right? I mean, we're building a big resource here, bending copyright far more than what Google's doing. We are creating a database of publications, news media, produced in real time over long swaths of time and then giving people access to it. We're doing it under the hopes that we don't get hit under anything other than fair use. We're going to restrict access to it because our servers can only take so much access to it. If you write really stupid research scripts that go and try to count every word in every book and then go back and check them every day to make sure that the book scanned, you know, published in 1888 and then scanned last week hasn't changed on a daily basis, you're going to harm the servers over time. So there are technical reasons why you'd want to prevent truly inept research from being done.
But that's around the first point. I think that covers, you know, access to being able to get to a research institution and actually get your research approved. And like I said, I understand that because you can't have the entire population going and doing, you know, considerable computing on something. There's just not, today, there's just not enough power to do that. But why would it be an okay thing to restrict the fruits of approved research? And who's approving the research, too? why would that be okay to restrict that to non-commercial use? You know, doesn't all innovation, often innovation is driven by, go ahead.
I'm kind of wondering what it would imply in practice, because if researchers are making their results publicly available, they cannot restrict that, like the use of that. It's just open, that then people will be able to use that like knowledge for commercial purposes as well. So I'm kind of wondering what it would mean in practice.
I think we're all wondering. You know, I think we don't know. We're just looking at these things and saying, what's our ideal? What's in a settlement that's a commercial settlement that's between two parties, that's not for the whole community, but how does that affect what we want to do over here? Mm-hmm. And in the same way, you know, privacy, the librarian code of ethics, we stand for confidentiality and privacy. We erase our records. We do not follow what you're looking at. What happens if we as a public library would have a terminal that was a subscription-based terminal where a user has to log in to get access to these books? Information on what they're reading, is that being combined with other information that companies already have about that individual? What does that mean for the protections that we've always offered? And is that just a little chip into our rights, or is that something much more significant?
Do you already have a concern with subscription services like LexisNexis?
We get rid of information.
But do they?
They don't, you know, they don't get the full user information from us. They get numbers of something. Pardon?
They get session information. You're certainly capable of tracking on their services what content people are looking at, putting together sessions.
But what do they know about that person?
It's a very similar parallel to what people worry about with Google. But this was the AOL search information case where, despite the fact that you had no identifying information on who the people were, you could make a great deal of judgments and draw conclusions just based on what they searched for.
Yeah.
So I get what you're saying, although if I'm sitting down anonymously at a terminal and I walk into a public library, I guess my concern would be more that search path information, which seems like it would be directly analogous to the concerns you'd have on something like LexisNexis.
Well, I think you're not sitting anonymously at the terminal, actually. I think you're logged in, and there's other information that Google certainly would have about you if you're using the Google search engine. So, again, is that going to be shared with scholars? Is that going to be combined in some new way? It's analogous, but I think the scope is probably what makes it seem daunting. We'll talk about that more. Fair use. You know, I think there was so much discussion about what was going to happen in fair use as the project went on before the settlement came. And the settlement provides a safe harbor for Google. So if Google, you know, distributes something that's not in the public domain by accident, they're not going to have financial consequences. But it doesn't provide a safe harbor for anybody else. And also, the traditional exceptions that we've had under copyright law have depended on works not being commercially available. So what happens to that now that works are, in effect, commercially available? What happens to those traditional protections? So, you know, we feel like the nonprofit sector is being bound to this settlement that was made in the for-profit sector that makes perfect sense in the for-profit sector, but what's going to happen? It could become difficult for us to justify digitization, because digitization has now got a kind of commercial attachment to it. Competition, again, the settlement, it's special and unique to one company, and it eliminates liability for Google, but there's a huge barrier of access to others. Just being able to get your hands on that kind of content, having the relationship already cemented with the publishers and authors, it would be a very big barrier for access to others. And so if you don't have competition, what happens to innovation? You know, you've got smaller smaller folks trying to carry on the same kind of fight, and that makes it quite difficult. The other thing that I just wanted to touch on before we just talk was this WorldCat record use policy. Again, this is this collective or collaborative, cooperative, all the C words, cooperative cataloging utility where we upload and download records. It's run by OCLC, which is a nonprofit in Ohio. It's a great service. It's allowed libraries that didn't have the ability to do cataloging to get catalog records for their books. It allows for many things to happen. You can transfer your records, reproduce them, incorporate data. But they recently came out with a policy that called for the insertion of a field of a license within every bibliographic record that said, this is licensed by WorldCat. So you are under license agreement. And it also, the policy also has a non-compete clause barring use of WorldCat for anything competitive in size or function or purpose. And I think you've had Aaron Schwartz here to talk about the Open Library. You know, that's one project that competes in a certain way, or competes in a very direct way. So the great thing about this is that a dialogue has started. So this policy came out, and immediately the community reacted pretty strongly, and OCLC responded and posted a different version of the policy. So now there's not an obligation to have the license in the record. They've taken that out, and they've made a recommendation that libraries include that license. You know, people are still talking about what the non-compete clause is going to mean for other non-commercial projects. You understand that OCLC has to protect its investment, but librarians, you know, are worried about the fruits of their work, of their intellectual input, being sewn up. So the great thing is that OCLC is responsive. There's a dialogue going on now, and we'll see what happens. And what that said to us is that a very loud and urgent voice is necessary to keep working towards our ideal. We're going to keep monitoring developments. We're going to keep working towards that open ideal, ramp up our advocacy strategy, and get public and legislative support, we hope, for the open knowledge environment. Chris Dodd, Senator Dodd, spoke via video conference at a summit that the Sloan Foundation sponsored over. It was held at the Boston Public Library at the end of September. We brought together everyone. We brought together, you know, the very open content advocates. Google was there. There was a very good discussion. Senator Dodd pledged his support, so we're excited about that. And I wanted to just close with a quote about the future. You know, it's impossible for us to predict it. We could spend a lot of time predicting it, but we'd rather just go ahead and build that ideal that we think is so important. More is good, better is our goal. And with that, thanks. Half a million that have been actually digitized using the Internet Archive Scribes. There's more pockets of content all over the place. For example, University of Michigan, which is a very big Google digitizing library, is also digitizing open content with their own facilities.
Okay, and how many books are there?
Oh gosh, in the universe, you know, you hear numbers anywhere from 150 million to Library of Congress has 30 odd million. Yeah, there's some math if you say, well, it costs $30 to digitize a book because it costs 10 cents a page. So if you, again, make a big assumption that the average pages in a book would be 300, it's 30 bucks a book.
And so where is this digitizing taking place? Like all over the world?
All over the world. Again, the Million Books Project has scanners in India, in China, in the United States. Here in this country, there's the facility that I had a picture of the Northeast Regional Scanning Center, which is at the Boston Public Library. There are other regional centers. The University of California has some, New York Public Library, the Smithsonian. The Sloan Foundation just funded $2 million for digitization of Library of Congress's collections. The Johns Hopkins University, University of Indiana, you name it, there's a lot of pockets of these scanning centers. We think we need more. It's you know, they're using really commercially available cameras. You can go into the camera store and buy cameras. The Scribe that Brewster Kahle and the Archive built is really just a metal framework that holds a book support with a glass plate that comes down. It's a pedal operated thing, so the operators sit and they push the pedal up, the glass lifts, they turn a page, they click, they take images of both pages, and on they go. They do hundreds of pages, 600, sometimes, you know, up to 800 pages an hour. It's interesting. It's a very specific kind of person. It's very zen. You know, it's very zen work. You've got they often sit and listen to music or to books on tape. And, you know, it's people who like books. It's not necessarily students.
They're just speed reading the books.
They're speed reading the books. Yeah. I think
that's why the books are not there.
Right, the books are not there, and I think that was tried with the open with the Million Books Project. I think, you know, Brewster could speak to that. I think they sent a whole bunch of books somewhere, and it didn't have a good result. So, you know, for example, in Boston, there's regional delivery services that the libraries use already. Libraries do a lot of exchange already anyway. There's interlibrary loan and other things. We're always shipping books to each other. So people have just piggybacked onto that. We worked with local movers, too, to be able to move book carts around. So they load up book carts. Again, down in Woods Hole, we get plastic-wrapped book carts come rolling in constantly. And there's a pretty good production flow now.
Into the scanner.
Into the scanning center. The archive developed a really good, you know, scanning workflow, so it's very efficient. What happens is the books are scanned. Overnight, the data gets sent out to California, where they do post-processing on it. They do de-skewing and working with the images. They run the OCR through it, and the next day you get the books back. You get a file that you can attach to the records in your catalog, and the books also appear in the Internet Archive.
Oh, good.
That's just one last more question. Why wouldn't the torrent model end up applying to this, where people just torrent the content like all over the place, and videos pop up everywhere, and
we talk about being able to really use each other's content at this point to replace, you know, if I have a copy, I shouldn't scan it if you've scanned it already. So we need that central database that tells us what's been done, what's not been done, and we need to be able to run. You know, libraries are still very attached to their collections. So they work very much with their collections.
Well, I mean, in terms of pirating. I mean,
it does exist. Append file type, right. Colon, DJVU to any book you want. That's probably the easiest way to get it in a lot of cases.
Right, exactly. I mean, I don't just think ahead. It seems like that's what's
going to
happen. Anyway,
we'll
see.
Yeah. So, perhaps a dumb question. So when these things get scanned, yep. Do you just get a JPEG of it? What is the file format? Is it OCR done on it, and then it's peeled off as text? Does the text then become HTML so that search engines can find it? I'm just wondering.
You get a number of derivatives that the archive creates. So you get a JP2, you get a flippy book where you can actually flip through the pages. You know, some people like that. You get searchable PDFs. You can pull down anything. You can pull down the bibliographic information. You know, there's all of the formats are available for you to pull in and use as you like. So.
Are they exposed on the web?
I'm really interested in the fact that you're a public library, and, you know, in
You're not?
I come from the public library. In my last life.
Okay. But the Boston Public, it's a Boston Public Library, right?
No, this organization is an independent organization. We're housed at the Boston Public Library, and I think a lot of our philosophy comes from that, you know, again, the free to all over the door of the BPL is this rallying cry. But many institutions, most are research institutions.
So I was just, in the point of bringing up the public library concept, at least, is that a lot of the organizations that we have coming here are public in the sense that they want to make information public. The other sense of public is that it's also publicly funded.
Right.
And I'm curious, in looking forward, where you see not so much the publicness of the project going so much as where, if it's a public benefit, one of the major mechanisms we have for funding public benefits is government. And I'm wondering what you see the future role of that might be.
Well, again, you know, we're all pushing for a big public works project to help with this. We realize that the scale of this is immense and that, you know, making the efforts that have been made already is a wonderful achievement, but it's got to be a lot more. We're trying to work on that level to get much more buy-in. We do think that, you know, many of these collections, they're owned by public universities that have been funded by taxpayer money. So the collections that have been purchased and stored and organized at considerable expense should be, you know, open. They should be able to circulate freely.
What would the relationship of that public work be to the privately funded efforts that are, have similar aims, but maybe not exactly the same aims or the same values?
Well, I think it doesn't matter where the funding comes from as long as the use is guaranteed. I mean, we're very grateful that we've had great funding and support from the private sector. There are a number of foundations that have funded projects because they think it's so important to push this into the public agenda. And, you know, I don't think any of them wants to single-handedly fund the entire transformation, but they're behind it so that these changes come about, for sure.
$30 a book, I'm wondering, are there books that are not worth scanning? in a universe of 150 million books.
Yeah.
And the reason I ask that question is that Brewster's Project, Million Books Project, Gutenberg, everybody stands up with this huge vision of digitizing all the world's books, which puts a certain scope on this project, right? It has to be huge and monumental.
It's an ideal.
There's other ways of framing this, right? And essentially saying, what are the most useful books, right? If we were going to frame this in terms of open educational materials, right, we would want to scan materials that were maximally useful for distributing to school children who don't have access to other textbooks, for instance. Are there other ways to frame this other than let's get them all? And what are the consequences of framing it as let's get them all?
No, definitely. And, you know, framing it as let's get them all is the great ideal. And we can say, you know, someday, as, you know, as we get to those last 20 million books and, you know, say, should we really scan these? It's an ideal. In the meantime, what's happened recently is that everyone that I've talked to in the library world has started talking a lot more about working with collections. It's the way that libraries always did work. They're interested in reuniting collections, and they're interested in supporting the missions of the institutions, the universities that they are part of. So what good is it to keep encouraging this digital library if your faculty goes online and can't find what they need? They can find only pieces of something. It's not in a coherent whole. So I've heard a lot of talk about that, and that's actually the genesis of the idea for the Library of North America. There's a bibliography called the Sabin Bibliotheca Americana, and it was put together by Joseph Sabin in the 19th century. He's one of those guys who sat down and said, I'm going to list every book that was printed in America and about America in every language. It's been shown to be a very useful collection of books that people want to get their hands on. There's only commercial access to a limited part of it. That's a place that people feel comfortable starting. You know, the biodiversity heritage people are working in the same way. We're seeing that disciplines are starting to focus. Way back in 2005, you know, people looked at starting digitization that way, but it turned out to be, University of California did all this work, it started to be much more expensive to actually select books than to just go to the shelves and take them off and dump them. But now we're moving back in that direction.
But even in going to the shelves and taking them off and dumping them, right? I mean, there's the selection between in copyright, not in copyright, between reachable rights holder and non-reachable rights holder, right? I mean,
oh, there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and
I guess what it seems to me in a lot of these projects is that it's extremely noble efforts to scan literature that is either easily accessible because it's available under public domain, or is of deep interest to a specific group of academic collaborators. That second seems absolutely logical, clearly should be done. Within this larger project, it seems like everyone's sort of dancing around the elephant in the room, which is that there's enormous amounts of stuff that is in copyright with a visible rights holder, perhaps in print, that we'd love to get and we can't, and therefore we're getting what we can, even knowing that, for instance, it isn't going to meet the average patron's needs. I'm thinking purely in terms of sort of what happens if you throw supply and demand on this, right?
Right.
I mean, essentially we're scanning based on what we have supplies of. We feel pretty confident, incredibly confident, that we can scan stuff that's out of copyright. And there's pathways towards being able to scan stuff that's in copyright but orphaned in one fashion or another. We're not there yet, but clearly we're headed in that direction.
Getting there. Yeah.
But it seems like if you were to actually do the sort of, you know, patron research and find out that, you know, what everyone wants is the Daniel Steele and the Agatha Christie,
yeah,
you can't touch that stuff, even if it's 85% of your market. And so it seems like instead of getting momentum behind this, that's going to end up being a problem at some point. If what 85% of what patrons want, you simply can't provide because of how copyright currently works, isn't this always going to be sort of a fringe movement and sort of a fringe interest?
Well, again, things will grow. We don't know how it's going to play out. I think, you know, we're not only doing this. We're starting with what we can do. And that's definitely the works in the public domain. That's definitely looking at ways to get at the orphans and make those more useful. Now, you've already got vendors who are doing ebooks. You know, you're starting to see that transition. People are actually starting to use ebooks. You know, Stanza has been downloaded more than Kindles have been sold, so we're starting to see that happen. Until we really start working with authors and publishers, authors directly, we won't know how we can fit into that world. And for now, I mean, I hear you. It's important, but for now, the person who's reading the Danielle Steele is still coming into the library and taking it off the shelf. We're seeing a greater need, perhaps, on the academic side. But, you know, we are looking at ways to push. Like, look at the Flickr Commons project. You know, yes, it's visual, it's different material, but as you push content out and make it findable to people, they have a way to work on it, and it causes conversations to happen. We're looking at ways to take, you know, to take all of the OCR of all of the open books we've got scanned, grind that up, pull out topics, pull out relevant terms, and marry that to places that people are already looking at content, and, you know, and mesh it into the open environment. Now we think that will at the very least cause more discussion, that will cause action in the community. We can't solve it all today, but I hear you. Yeah.
I had a question which is kind of connected. I think you said that you didn't want to restrict the project to officially published books. Did I understand that correctly? So you said like the types of materials and books that go into that, it's like it's not, you don't have like a clear boundary of...
No, well, we see, we're memory holders, so we have lots of other, we have photographs and lithographs and lots of other things.
Mm-hmm.
Formats, there's video formats, there's...
So what would be the boundary of in an exclusion of material? Is that just like everything that's illegal won't go in, or what is the, how do you see that boundary? So basically anything goes that is not illegal, or...
You mean on the work that we're doing today, or on, you know, on the idea, you know, if you can start to work towards a central registry that creators can have confidence in, that they can have access to their rights, you know, that their that distribution of their creations online isn't going to totally take away their rights as holders of that. That's what you want. I don't think we're going to start defining, well, we'll do just photographs or just videos. I mean, we're just talking about the production of knowledge and.
No, but for instance, libraries traditionally have certain boundaries, know what kind of material they take in their selection. I think maybe the amount of pages sometimes plays a role, or for instance, like books that are self-published, that like an author has paid to get the book published, they don't usually take those books.
Oh, you mean we select our, we, you're talking about collection development here, and that's, you know, the answer to the earlier question, is it right to digitize everything? Well, some people hold that everything was curated, everything was chosen, so therefore it should all be digitized. There are some other views with that. The question of self-publishers and how you build collections, it hasn't been answered yet. It hasn't been answered yet. But I think, you know, you're going to see the need for more editors, you know, librarian skills or whoever's organizing information. There are going to have to be guides into the content. So I think you'll see editing come up as a much bigger function of the library, and you know, creating guides to subject areas, much like the scientists in the Biodiversity Heritage Library project. You know, they're taking their literature and providing a framework to navigate that literature. I think that will happen more and more. But we do need more content. I mean, I know, you know, back to, let's just take it all. 500,000 books is a drop in the bucket. You know, we do have to, we do have a lot of transformative work to do.
I have a question to your side.
Oh, hi.
I mean, coming back to the elephant in the room for a second, there's a lot more than Daniel Steele that's still under copyright. And yeah. I think it's fair to say that in most scientific disciplines, a large portion of the technical things that you want are also the things still under copyright. And I mean, it's also a question of convenience in many cases, in that, so there was a book that I was interested in a few weeks ago. It was just published by Springer. The MIT Library had it on order. It hadn't arrived yet. Yeah. They also had it online available through a proxy server. You could download it one chapter at a time, yeah. Or you could go to a single link and download it legally all at once. Now, it's clear which of those three is the easiest for actually getting the work done with the book that I wanted.
Right.
And, but I mean, there's also sort of no possibility that it, in the near term, could enter into a framework of this, because it's very clearly copyrighted. It came out this year. It's good for 85 more years, or I guess until the person dies and then more. And it's quite unclear how the bulk of these books that are most useful for a lot of purposes ever enter into this sort of framework.
It isn't, I mean, if you say the Google agreement, they don't even touch that. And the agreement ends, you know, in 2009. It doesn't cover books that will be published in the future. So for in copyright, in print works, there's no provision in that agreement. It's basically nothing can be shown, the bibliographic data can be shown, and you can be referred to a source to buy it or get it through traditional means. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think in this case, and in the case of a lot of scientific books, Google has agreements with the publisher which are, you know, less restrictive than just these snippets, because the publishers are happy for that. And so I think both Google and Amazon, in the case of a lot of these, you know, will show you 10 pages for free and let you do basic searching. But still, I mean, it's not even a question of commercial versus non-commercial even so much as the reason that this Springer site was annoying is just that, you know, it's a bad interface, you have to go through a proxy server. Not on campus, and still they're just chopping it up in a way that makes it inconvenient. Right. You know, MIT has bought the license, but even still, it's easier for me to get the other version.
Anybody else
on the other hand, it also doesn't cost $30 to deal with, because it's pretty clear that that copy that was illegal was assembled by somebody who's at a university that had the license. They just took the individual PDFs, concatenated them, mm-hmm. and so then you have a copy much better than a scanned copy. It takes about 2 megabytes. It's fully searchable, has everything perfectly, and costs a lot less than $30.
What did you do?
What did I do? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's, well, I described before in general.
You're on the record.
No, I mean, Google is also the best source for this in the sense that, you know, if you, what I was saying before, if you append file type colon DJVU to your search, you're apt to get all sorts of torrents or direct sites or, I mean, you know, the DJVU file format is used by Carnegie Mellon for their million books, but it's also good for books in general.
What were you?
It's also where a lot of the innovation is taking place, not just, you know, the thing that is ignored in a lot of us.
I got asked actually three questions, but very brief. First, how do you handle the coordination issue among, you know, all these dispersed initiatives with one major, the Google one probably, right? If I'm right.
It's the major one, yeah.
So how do you handle it not to duplicate your efforts? You mentioned a database, but is this all, or you have some more kind of institutionalized?
We're starting these things now. I mean, it's grown up organically. So you've had, you know, you've had scanning centers contributing content. The Internet Archive is a place where you can find a lot of it, but we don't have that central registry yet. We don't have a central database yet. You know, we don't have the pockets.
Then to what extent your efforts in the past have been kind of duplicated?
Well, actually,
duplicated by multiplying the same.
There are tools developed by the biodiversity people, developed a tool that's a deduping tool. So they'll basically run, you know, whenever you select books to be scanned, you create a pick list of those books so that all the bibliographic records can be pulled electronically. Mm-hmm. So they run that list against the, you know, they have a central database, and that's something that we're looking to incorporate into what happens in the broader world. Some libraries will actually go and check and see if you know, if manually, and see if things have been done already. That's really time consuming.
All right. Yeah. Then the second question is about other languages than English.
Yeah.
To what extent any of these efforts has focused on other languages? What languages are there?
Well, the goal is to go there. The scientific literature, the biodiversity literature, is full of other languages. The reason that we chose as a kind of project to get behind the Library of North America is that it includes all of the literature in all the European languages about the discovery of this continent. So we wanted to be able to let those humanists do some of the work that they're anxious to do with multilingual machine translation and so on.
So it's more focused on the collections and what is in the collections than on language, right?
It has been. Of course, English prevails because a lot of the collections are in English, but it's definitely focused on the collections. Yeah.
And then third question, to what extent did you digitalize stuff within the castle, this in copyright, in print?
The castle isn't only in copyright and print. Okay. The castle is,
you don't touch it,
is anything that's enclosed.
Yeah. And you don't touch it within your,
well, I don't, but people, you know, advocates of open content are touching it, so it's happening.
Do you expect the $30 per book cost to scan to drop in the future, or is that pretty much as low as it's likely to be?
Right now, it's a really good cost. I mean, right now, you know, I think people have tried on their own to duplicate that cost, and they can't. The archive has worked hard on it. They're good at it. They've reproduced it all over the place. It's a good cost. There's also a cost for, you know, the OCR, and there's some hard costs built into that. So we're happy with it right now, but I mean, 4 years ago we were happy with $4 a page, so, because that's what it cost. That's what it cost 4 years ago. When I got to the Boston Public Library, when I was still working there, we were digitizing John Adams' private library, and it cost us thousands of dollars to do a single book. So in this short period of time, it's amazing, and that's why libraries are saying, look, we can do this. We've got books that no one's been able to look at forever. We can do this.
And private libraries have an interest in it? I was thinking of the Boston Athenaeum, for example, cooperating in some way.
You know, I don't know. We just haven't spoken to them yet. It's.
I would think it'd be attractive to them.
I would think, yeah.
Some of that anyway. think I've seen some machines that look like that, but you know, they're crying poverty like everybody else. I think it would attract more people.
Well, they've also done some things where they're trying to bring in younger members, and they've had a series of talks on digital technology, so they're trying to introduce people to it.
So I
think
have you?
Yeah.
Seems reasonable.
We just haven't spoken to, there's a lot of folks to talk to. I'll put them on my list.
So the majority of all new books that are coming out have already been digitized initially before they've even been printed.
Sure.
So it seems like once the 150 or 300 or however many million books that have already been published and the files thrown away or whatever are done, then there won't be any cost anymore to digitize books, right?
No, there won't. We have to do this transformation, and again, it's not only books, it's manuscripts and...
Right, it's media. Yeah. It's hard media that doesn't exist on file. But.
Right. And that's why this is a chunk of time. I mean, we're going from that to this.
And how many new books are just being sent directly to online services?
I don't have the publishing numbers in front of me. I don't know. Yeah.
In the case of the Harper's Weekly example that you gave, so the content is under public domain, but the particular way it's distributed has these restrictions. So is it the case that if somebody were to go into the library in person and somehow liberate that data, then anybody could copy it freely on the outside.
Yeah.
But so this is an example of a sort of castle that you don't go in in terms of, say, this project, but you know, in the near future, but you know, any particular case that's then brought out is then part of the collection that everyone has.
Right. It's, you know, especially for works in the public domain, it's a no-brainer. There are non-exclusive agreements in place where vendors have come in, and again, it's been a help to libraries because they weren't able to digitize their stuff, so it was a way of increasing access. So they gave access to vendors to come in and scan it.
So in the case of, say, the Harper's Weekly, the people who are charging for this restrictive license at the moment are the ones who laid out to scan it in the first place, realizing that once it escapes, they've lost their investment, but...
Yes.
Maybe they can get it back in the short term through this sort of arrangement.
And we've talked with a number of them. I mean, people are trying to play with models where you say, okay, we can't do it all. Can we, not everyone feels the same way about this. Can we allow a vendor to digitize something that we can't reach into our pockets to digitize and allow them to make back their money up front and then have a sunset clause on that agreement where after 5 years it goes right back into the public domain because... Access is better than no access, and eventual open access is better than, again, no access. So that's something that people are talking about, too. You know, people are trying to be governed by reason here. You know, we're reaching for an ideal, but there are so many problems to solve. But,
I was really interested in what you mentioned about maybe
back in terms of like libraries being able to do stuff with copyright protected material because there are certain now commercially viable projects that are basically making material available in the marketplace, and so my understanding is a lot of those exceptions for libraries, they're based on the idea of market failure and providing access to material. So could you expand a little bit on your worries on this front? And so what would be your argument against it? But how do you see that this could be going? I was wondering if you could say a little bit more
again,
about
that. Yeah, again, I'm just so anxious to have the copyright lawyers in the room help us out on this. You know, in the most simplistic terms, what we see is fair use was allowed. You know, if there were the tests for fair use. Are you reproducing the thing in its entirety? Are you ruining the market value? And keep going. Mm-hmm. So if something was not commercially available, you know, it was an easier judgment call to be able to say, I can take this and let someone use it and make certain copies of it, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if it is available in, you know, if you can license it, what does that what does that do? Are we going to be held to that? Are we going to say, well, if I allow this person to copy this portion of this work, then I'm taking away from, you know, the proceeds that would result from that? And is that a violation?
Mm-hmm. I know more about the situation in Europe. So, like, but there we have also, like,
well, Europe has the whole PLR, the public lending right,
yeah.
And that's a, you know, it's a whole different system. And that's,
yeah,
another interesting thing. You know, what happens in this global world as we start, what are there, 41 countries that have a public lending right that remunerates creators for the lending of their works in analog form?
Yeah.
You know, what happens as we start to mesh?
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
You mentioned about the difficulty of going through, you know, scanning all these books around the world, but how about the distributed proofreaders approach? Have you considered that as a possibility of expanding this kind of action?
Well, actually, interestingly, we thought about them for manuscripts because, mm-hmm, you know, the archives hold, you know, millions of manuscripts. And again, at, you know, at Boston in my previous life, we were going to digitize some of the anti-slavery collection. It's a lot of the Boston abolitionists have written manuscripts. They're there. Mm-hmm. So usually what institutions do, bless you, is, you know, they painstakingly image and then transcribe the manuscripts. You have double proofreaders, you mark it up in some TEI, some text encoding initiative markup or something. And we thought, well, you know, if people are really out there scurrying over all the content, why don't we put the images up and put them out there and particularly try to push it into the community that would be most interested in that and see what happens there. So that idea is going around. I mean, you know, everyone's excited about crowdsourcing. We'll see how far that goes and what work can actually be done. Like, I know that the people at the Flickr Commons haven't allowed for a wholesale dumping of new content into the Commons. I think there's a 1-year waiting period for any new institution to be able to get their stuff up on the Commons. And the reason for that is they want to open the faucet gradually. They want to give the community time to work on it, to process the new material. They don't want people to be overwhelmed by just a sea of content with no context and with no interactions on it. So, yeah, it's an interesting model, exactly how to execute it.
I mean, I was a little bit puzzled because I'm studying crowdsourcing,
yeah,
part of my research. But one of the things I saw, just looking at the statistics again on the distributed proofreader site,
yeah,
they were pretty excited and they were going up very,
yeah,
quickly, and now they're kind of like stalled. Uh-huh. And I'm not puzzled why
tell us why.
Right.
Yeah.
I have,
yeah,
to look it up again. I'm,
yeah,
just thinking, you know, there's some momentum that has been lost apparently, but
yeah,
I know that motivation for them was, you know, to open it up to the world. Now we're talking about, you know, Google having some kind of restrictions and others having their own interests on the table, you know, that somehow prevent from truly open access to all, at,
yeah,
least immediate open access to all. So that might be playing a role for them also participating or not participating, you know, because they're contributing free time and effort.
Right.
Right. So just a guess. I don't know that I know the answer why, but the main motivation is to make it all open completely, right? So,
yeah,
they should come back.
They should come back. Yeah.
I'm concerned about the future of Cory Doctorow's statement. So, I mean, I agree that it's fortunate that at the moment that it can be a win-win situation, but,
yep,
you know, people are gradually getting more comfortable reading online, maybe, you know, a lot slower than people originally thought was going to happen. But it doesn't seem at all obvious to me that it will continue to be a win-win situation in the future. I mean, if at some point you're just as happy reading your copy online, then it's not clear that it increases sales to give away the only copy that people would care to buy to begin with. Nor is,
sure,
it, I mean, it's also not clear how you could sell that in the first place if copies are able to leak out, but,
right,
I mean, it seems like there's a sort of short window in which
there is a short
those
window
are the rules.
I, you know, I agree. We're in this transition time, and right now it works because still a preferred method. You know, people are still preferring to read books, so,
mm-hmm,
it's working as a marketing tool, as a finding tool. But I agree with you, but, you know, we won't know till we get there. Or we'll know right before we get there. Yeah.
Like in the past, it was more to such a point that people are, you know, will be willing to comply with what.
That's where the Europeans are going with their PLR. I mean, they're you know, they're applying that concept.
It seems that music is fundamentally different. So there's a great article by James Glick sort of about this Google settlement, but also talking about the difference between between books and music. People talk about being book lovers. They don't talk about being CD lovers. They say they're music lovers. Right? Once you have the file on your iPod, you don't care where you got it from or whether you paid for it or not. That's the only thing you care about, the ability to play the music. Whereas a book is nicer than having the content on your laptop or something. But music has long passed the point where we care about the delivery mechanism, even though books are fortunately nicer.
So do you think that will change? Yeah, go ahead.
Push back on that, right? I mean, that may be true in a country where books are well within most people's disposable.
It's entirely different in other parts of the world. Yeah. So the nasty phony question that I've been sort of trying to put together and
figure out how to throw across that side of the table,
yeah,
has to do whether this isn't fundamentally just a deeply conservative project. And essentially saying that, you know, the radical approach to this would be to say, libraries were all about taking things which were consumer products that were expensive, that made a lot of money, and making them accessible to people in the best technology of the time at little or no cost. If you guys really wanted to be radical, you'd digitize everything. You would stand behind fair use. You would make it all accessible from my laptop simply because I had an affiliation and a membership with my library.
So you've got a library card and you can log in.
And I can log in and I can read everything. I can read the piece that you were trying to get from MIT. I can read the Daniel Steele. I can read whatever I want. That's the radical vision. This builds on a critique put together by a couple of Indian open content scholars who think that Larry Lessig, our dear friend, and we're happy to have him returning to the center, has been radically damaging the open content movement. And they think he's a total sellout, and they think that he should be actively supporting piracy, because they point out in India, where they live and work, the only conceivable way that you're ever going to get through university is by pirating your textbooks. There's no conceivable way that the average Indian can afford to purchase the books to finish a bachelor's degree. So in a system that's obviously that economically unfair, where people are obviously going to find whatever way to access these books no matter what, why not simply blow the thing up? So is there, you know, so the response to this would be to say, is there a way in which you're sort of giving copyright holders a response? Sure, you know, you have to pay to access our stuff. We need to pay people. No, we're not going to protect fair use as much as you'd like. But hey, here's 148 million other things that have been digitized. Go read that instead. I know you want to read the latest scientific research, but here's a wonderful text from 1870 that you might find fascinating.
No, we're not going to stay in the 1870s. We're really not. You know, again, what's practical to do today, right this moment, so that we don't lose momentum, it, you know, might not be the Danielle Steele that you're talking about. But it's a work in progress. It's a work in progress. And the ideal is maybe not a radical world where we tromp on people's rights, but the ideal is to find a way to provide open access. And you know, what I'm hoping to hear today is to hear that's your take on it. You know, what are the rest of you, how would you counter that?
Not actually my take on it.
Well, no,
I'm trying to be provocative because we're a university, and this is
kind of an academic thing, because it's quite clear as a project, if you would do that, you end up in court and you lose like Napster did. No, so that is not.
I mean, libraries managed to do this based on a first sale doctrine. Why doesn't the first sale doctrine apply digitally? Is that inherently an analog technology? I'm not talking about scanning everything and not paying for it. I'm talking about purchasing the single copy and making it accessible to, and maybe you lock them, and maybe you say, no, I'm sorry, you can't look at that Daniel Steele file right now because someone else is looking at it at the moment or downloading it at the moment.
Like, but there's, you allow 200 people at the same time to look at that.
Right, maybe there's a simultaneity
That's limiting access again. You know, that's limiting access again. And
I guess I simply don't accept that just because there's going to be a lawsuit, you shouldn't do it.
No, I agree with that.
And
some people are pushing that. I think the archive is pushing that. They're looking at lending digital books. So the work is starting to happen. And what I'm saying to you is, you know, I don't know we're in the planning stages here. I don't know how our whole strategy is going to look around that, because I haven't sat down with all of the copyright people and all of the library people and all of the idealists and mapped it out, but it's starting.
But one of the things that I've thought of in the European context, which is related to this, is that as public institutions and like in Europe, it's all public library movement that is doing this kind of project. It makes sense for them to be more conservative. You know, they come from the kind of establishment, and like whereas Google comes with this kind of disruptive way of building a new commercial product.
That
they see some kind of interest for themselves. That is for public institutions, they're more conservative in many ways, no? And it's like to do this kind of really disruptive things, I'm not sure, like especially in the European context, I don't see that they see that happening that much. I think it just because of their public nature. Yeah.
Because, you know, no one wanted to get sued.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I guess I mean one thing that that has really helped the distribution of books, copyrighted or not, is their small size. So I mean, maybe libraries can't deal with the sort of things that are on sketchiest legal ground, or in fact clearly illegal, for all sorts of reasons, including lawsuits and conservatism of the institution, whatever. But on the other hand, book piracy is able to flourish in a way that other sorts of piracy can't even. I mean, the files are already too small to torrent on their own. There's a whole other infrastructure that's arisen around them. Occasionally, you can torrent, you know, 1,000 books at once, and then that's large enough that it actually stays as an active torrent. But it's not too long until, you know, the whole bulk of copyrighted material could be copied in about as much time as to get the latest super high definition movie. And so, I mean, it seems like, you know, even if libraries can't deal with these copyrighted books for good reasons, the end game is that they become, you know, available to anyone who wants them extremely quickly, which is, you know, not that bad from a standpoint of having access to the content.
I'd also like to just raise one little point with regards to access.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I originally come from Bolivia, and I've worked there for a little while, and I was, you know, stunned the first time I heard about the statistics in terms of penetration. You know, PC penetration was like a 3%, you know, yeah. Internet penetration 1.5%. And basically when you go to the universities, what you find is lots of stands that are selling like pirate books for like, you know, $1 instead of like the 100 that the technical books cost. But then you go to the library itself at the university, and their books are also pirate versions of the books. So, you know, you are looking at it's just access. Even the university cannot afford, you know, even national university cannot afford to have all the original books with the copyrights and everything, you know, for the prices that they stand for, you know, for very, very current material.
Right.
So,
there's a math professor here who has a Chinese copy of his own book. We asked him why. He said, it's cheaper.
That's right. So access goes beyond it, you know.
Yeah.
The books that we know of, and having access to the internet is a big, big problem too.
Thank you. Thank you for all.